Today on Studio 360.
I think more editors should live with their films longer. You have to live with the film.
For four decades, Thelma Schoonmaker has been Martin Scorsese's closest collaborator and most patient.
We sometimes like to do 12 edits of our movies. Yeah, it takes a long time to get it right.
The Oscar-nominated editor of The Irishman breaks down their painstaking process. Plus,
I'm not afraid of cinema. I love cinema. I'm not trying to make cinema disappear.
Why Quentin Tarantino, up for an Oscar for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, makes no apologies for filling his movies with quotes from other movies.
You know, could you imagine an author having read too many books? I love cinema. I have no problem basking in cinema and its history.
Oh, you're looking good, baby.
It's our 2020 Oscar Hour, coming up on Studio 360. Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
And I'm sitting on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
This first level of garden.
This is Thomas Jefferson's vegetable garden.
I'd like to have the roasted chicken, please. Very well done.
Editing is all about timing.
I try to get a little bit away from the actual subject.
You must get sick of your own voice, right?
Studio 360.
With Kurt Anderson.
The Academy Awards are upon us, so we're spending this hour on Studio 360 looking at some of the nominated films and talking with the people who made them, such as Martin Scorsese's epic gangster movie The Irishman, which is up for 10 awards.
So what do you want me to know?
No, not that. Not that. What you gotta do is, you know, put a firecracker up Dorfman's ass. Fitz will get the message. He'll get the message.
On The Irishman, Scorsese worked once again with Robert De Niro and once again with Joe Pesci. And once again with his closest collaborator, who's up for one of those Oscars for The Irishman, film editor Thelma Schoonmaker. She worked with him on his very first feature when they were kids in 1967 and on every one of Scorsese's films since 1980. She's cut everything from the balletic fight sequences in Raging Bull to those crazed, hilarious, drugged-out party scenes in Wolf of Wall Street.
That's one of the great things about working for him, is that every film is different. He never wants to repeat himself.
I talked with Thelma Schoonmaker in 2017 about their long partnership.
He sets himself certain challenges with each film, and I get to go over the hurdle with him, which is very, very exciting. It makes every film a new wonderful adventure, and I just love it.
Right. So walk me through how you and Martin Scorsese work together. I mean, you say you see a script, you see a shooting script right before he mm-hmm. shoots, and then you wait till you get the film and you do your thing. Is that it? Or is he with you? Or do you sit down for a couple of days and say, okay, this I think goes here and this maybe is shorter? How does that work?
Well, I always do the first cut.
On your own?
Yes, from his, when he looks at dailies with me, that's very important.
And you do that as you're shooting?
Yes, hopefully. Once he looks at dailies, then he gives me a ton of notes and I tell him what I feel. He wants me to be a cold eye looking at the dailies and tell him if there's anything wrong.
And he says the third take is great and you say, no, it's the fifth take.
That's right. So I take very careful notes from that and then I make selects in descending order of preference of the delivery of the line, for example. And then I make the first cut. And then as soon as he's through shooting, he comes in and we do everything else together. We sometimes like to do 12 edits of our movies.
And how many weeks is that?
It depends. Sometimes it can be as long as a year.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes it can be 6 months. We cut Cape Fear in 6 months.
But never less than 6 months?
No.
Wow, that's a hard job.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get it right, you know, and
so that's like 30 seconds a day or less.
No.
I just did the math. It is.
You know, it's just very, we work really hard and we screen much more and recut much more than most editors are allowed to do. Fortunately, we are allowed to do that.
Right.
I think more editors should live with their films longer. You have to live with the film.
Absolutely.
Really
or anything.
Live with it.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's so important. And then, of course, all the finishing work takes a long time, putting the music in and the sound effects and mixing it and
right.
all of that.
Are you still highly involved in that process?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah. I mix the rough cuts.
So you're really the director. You're really the filmmaker. We should start saying Thelma Schoonmaker films.
Not at all. Marty is very much the director.
Yeah.
I'm his collaborator. Everybody goes, yeah, but you know, it's true.
I know.
He's a great editor. He taught me everything I ever know about editing.
So what did he teach you? Like, for instance, how do you use editing and holding on a character to build the character? What's an example of that?
Well, one thing that would be something you might know, which is that in the scene in Goodfellas where Joe Pesci is asking, "What's so funny about me?"
What do you mean I'm funny? It's funny, you know. It's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk?
What? It's just, you know, you're just funny. It's funny, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you. I make you laugh. I'm here to fucking amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
One of the interesting cuts that we made there is this is a situation that actually happened to Joe Pesci himself, and he told Marty about it, and then Marty decided to put it in the film.
Uh-huh.
So actually the Ray Liotta character is who Joe Pesci was, and Joe Pesci is playing the mafia guy who's tormenting him. And Pesci told Marty, "I knew at a certain point that I had to figure out a way to break it with humor or something, or I was going to get killed." And so we spent a long time trying to figure out how long to wait for Ray Liotta to say,
"Get the fuck out of here, Tommy."
And we tried it with 8 seconds. We tried it with 7 seconds. We tried it with...
If somebody's going to get killed right here.
Six seconds of time.
Right.
And after the last explosive and threatening remark...
"How the fuck am I funny? What the fuck is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny."
Instead of cutting to Ray Liotta and having him say the line right away, Marty told him, "Wait." And then...
"Get the fuck out of here, Tommy."
And everybody starts to laugh. So we tried many different lengths of how long to hold on Ray Liotta. That's the kind of thing that editing is about. And one of the things I tell students, too, that whole sequence was shot in a medium wide. There were no close-ups in it at all because Marty wanted to show what was happening to the people around Ray Liotta and around Joe Pesci. As it starts out very funny, everybody's laughing, then pretty soon things begin to get a little scary, and they get scarier and scarier, and you see on the faces of the people around them that they're really beginning to get worried. And that was a great lesson for me in the right use of technique. You don't always have to have close-ups. Sometimes a medium shot or a wide shot is just as good.
Well, and it's interesting that he said wait, and there's a version of comedy going on in that horrible, oh my God, scene. So it is a timing thing of a second or two.
Well, editing is all about timing and rhythm, you know, between two actors, and so that we often will delay a line delivery, or for example, Marty sometimes will take the sound out, as he did in Silence. There's a scene where Kichichiro steps on a fumi, and it swish pans to his mother, who's horrified.
And just so people know who that is, it's this kind of skeevy Christian character, right?
Right.
And who is forced to step on an image of Jesus.
Of Jesus to show that he's apostatizing, giving up the faith, supposedly. And the camera swish pans to his mother, screaming in horror that he's done this. And Marty said, "Take the sound out." And it's so powerful. It's so powerful. And there are several other times where we did that in the movie, too. And there have been other times where we've done it in Raging Bull, for example, when Sugar Ray Robinson cannot get Jake LaMotta to go down in the last crucial fight. And he can't figure out what he can do to get him to go down. And Marty did this incredibly beautiful shot, where Sugar Ray pulls back, the lights dim, and you just see Sugar Ray standing there breathing. You hear just the sound of an animal breathing. And our sound editor, Frank Warner, said to us, "Take the sound away." And then go back to Sugar Ray, and the lights come back up, and the camera comes back up to speed, and he comes in for the kill. And so all of that is what makes editing and great camera work and great directing.
Yes. Thelma, this was just the greatest. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thelma Schoonmaker's been nominated for an Academy Award for her editing of The Irishman. She's already won three for Raging Bull, The Aviator, and The Departed. To hear Thelma Schoonmaker give a literal blow-by-blow of how she edited one of the great fight scenes in Raging Bull, go to studio360.org. Another Oscar contender this year is Noah Baumbach's drama Marriage Story, which stars Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver.
How dare you compare my mothering to my mother? I may be like my father, but I am not like my mother.
You are! And you're like my father. You're also like my mother. You're all the bad things about all of these people, but mostly your mother.
It'll be interesting to see during the Oscar TV show exactly how Adam Driver reacts when they play a clip of his Best Actor-nominated performance. Because he hates seeing or hearing himself on screen so much that a few months ago he walked out on Terry Gross in the middle of an interview for Fresh Air when she played a clip of him. Which surprised me, because when I talked to him in 2013, he was indulgent as we watched one of his scenes from the TV show Girls. I did ask him why it made him so uncomfortable.
Lots of reasons. I just forgot what I looked like and was reminded, oh my God, that's no one should have to go through that. But mostly because I feel like if it was going to continue, if it was going to kind of go on, that, I came from a theater background where you don't get to look at the end result or what is actually being across. Right. You just have to do your homework and then as much as you can, and then show up on the day and be open to something being different or not knowing the answer. And I think that in things that I've watched in the past, like one, I would just obsess about them for months and drive myself crazy.
After you saw your work.
Yeah, of things that I wanted to fix and change or do over again. And I obviously you can't. And same thing with the people around me. I just drive them nuts with like asking him questions. That's annoying.
Yeah, but wouldn't it allow you to like, oh, next time I won't do that.
Oh, totally.
Better the next time.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea. It just kind of seems to be what I think. I think I have a natural tendency to try to make things perfect or better looking or change it for the sake of changing it, arbitrary changing or making it look better. And the things that I'm interested in watching in film and theater and television are always the imperfect or the ugly part of it. And I just know of myself, especially while we're shooting it, like I have no interest to see like what is coming across.
On this show, I ask guests a lot about their kind of aha moments as young people, the thing they saw or experienced or read or whatever that made them pursue whatever creative field they're in. I read that the moment you realized you wanted to be an actor wasn't in a theater or watching TV, but during basic training in the Marines?
No, it wasn't basic training. It was in the fleet. Artillery was firing white phosphorus over us. I was a mortarman.
And as a training exercise?
Yeah, it was a training. Yeah, and got the coordinates wrong and they fired on us as opposed to the target. So it was really windy and coupled with the fact that all of us were running
away from it?
Away from it.
Because if it touched you, it would burn you and...
Yeah. And that was kind of my first experience with, even though I'm young, I could die. And the two things that I wanted to do is I wanted to smoke and be an actor. That didn't have any relation to each other. I never really smoke cigarettes. I want to see what...
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
I want to see what that is like.
Yeah, I almost got killed. Let me kill myself.
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
And then you got injured, right? And didn't stay in the Marines?
No, yeah, I broke my sternum.
And had that not happened and had the Marines worked out, would you have ended up where you are now, do you think?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I didn't want to go. Like being a civilian again and all kind of getting my civilian privileges was like a hard thing to swallow, especially when they were kind of overseas doing their job and I wasn't. Like I was here in New York in acting school. Like that was kind of a really difficult transition. And I would say I still regret not being able to
go through the full enlistment.
Yeah. With that specific group of people. I mean, like
which is what it's all about at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Point, right?
There's no like, you kind of join for whatever reasons and, you know, we all kind of had reasons, but as soon as you kind of get in with that group of guys, you kind of forget about the outside. I remember very specific moments of being in the chow hall and watching, President Bush then being like, our military is in a high state of alarm. And I'm like, really? We're on red alert? You know, I'm here eating eggs right now and thinking about getting a second helping of potatoes. Like where the outside world seems something completely disconnected and we wanted to go and do our jobs with this, you know, group of guys. And the idea of not being with them through that is like, there's no way to describe.
And where did they deploy to?
They went over, they did a Westpac in, of Iraq and Afghanistan.
And now that you're an actor and you're on in casts, and does it, is it hard for you not to feel as casts get together and feel, oh, we're part of this group? And like, you don't know what you're talking about. I was in the Marines with this unit that I felt. That was feeling close to people.
I think I, when I first got out, I had a really strong sense of entitlement about being in the military and like not, and adjusting to civilian life and getting really aggressive with civilians about like, what are you like complaining about getting in line for a latte? Like, you know, they're but I've since I don't really think that's – I've been fortunate enough to find acting to be able to find the language to express that. So I feel like I haven't gotten – like I started to calm down a little bit.
And no longer judging civilians?
Well, there's also – right. Well, there's also a strong connection between the military, I think, and theater or acting and just that, you know –
in that band of brothers kind of way?
Yeah, but – yeah, that there's – you know, you're trying to accomplish a mission that's greater than yourself. It's not really about you. You have to know your role within a team. You know, you have to be intimate with people in a short amount of time, and the stakes are really high. The pressure is really high. Obviously, life or death circumstances don't really compare to, you know, bad crafty, but still, the sentiment of trying to accomplish something that is not about one specific person and putting your trust within other people and the discipline and the self-maintenance, it all applies.
Well, Adam Driver, it has been a pleasure meeting you. Thanks.
Oh, likewise. Thanks for having me.
Adam Driver is nominated for Best Actor for his role in Marriage Story. Coming up next...
Thank the Oscars. That's why we came to you.
I never won an Oscar.
And that's a damn shame.
He's the most enduring star in Hollywood, recognized all over the world, immortalized in gold. But who was this guy, Oscar?
Well, he was apparently great friends with John Wayne. He supposedly taught Rudolph Valentino to tango. He's a bit like a Forrest Gump.
The real man behind the statue. That's next on Studio 360.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Studio 360.
We are devoting this whole hour of Studio 360 to the Oscars. It's officially the Academy Awards, but people all call it the Oscars because of that statue, which hasn't changed a bit since the late 1920s. The abstracted Art Deco figure plated in gold. But those pecs, those thighs, those shoulders, they came from a real guy. And his name was not Oscar. Posey Gruner has the story.
They called him El Indio. And in Mexico, he's kind of a big deal. His real name was Emilio Fernandez, and he was one of Mexico's greatest directors.
Y ahora ya conoces la historia de esta tierra, que es la historia de toda la tierra de México.
He died in 1986, and his home in Mexico City has been turned into a museum.
La Puerta del Indio.
Cristobal Arias Gomez is the historian there.
Bueno, el Indio es una persona, un personaje consagrado.
El Indio is a sacred figure. It's like he's already made it into history for all the great work he's accomplished.
Together with his muse, Dolores del Rio, and his cinematographer, Gabriel Figueroa, Fernandez made some of the best films from the golden age of Mexican cinema. Emilio Fernandez led a big life. And he told some big stories.
Well, he was apparently great friends with John Wayne. He told John Steinbeck the story that became the novella, The Pearl. He supposedly taught Rudolph Valentino to tango. He's a bit like a Forrest Gump.
Dolores Tierney teaches film at the University of Sussex. She wrote a book about Fernandez. She believes some of his stories. As for the story that he posed for the Oscar, she finds it persuasive.
This one seems to be quite true because there are a number of things that point to its veracity.
For example, Fernandez had a great physique.
A legendary physique, according to many of his biographers.
Tierney has a photo of Fernandez that was taken when he was young. He's standing in swim trunks, and he kind of looks like the Oscar.
You know, very broad chest, very slim waist, you know, very similar to the Oscar statuette.
Even his nose seems kind of Oscar-like.
Not broad, not thin, a kind of a distinguished nose, I'd say.
And Fernandez had that same bearing, that way of thrusting his shoulders back.
Era un personaje robusto, era un personaje atlético.
He had a robust, athletic figure. He went to the military academy. And so he had a unique type of body, a body that was very unusual for people to have at the time. So obviously that's why he was chosen to be the model for the Oscar.
It's kind of funny how it all happens. So here's the story. Fernandez grew up in Mexico. And in 1923, when Pancho Villa was killed, Fernandez dropped out of military college to join the Huertista rebels. When they lost, he got 20 years in prison. He only escaped because he jumped the border, and he landed in Hollywood. At that time, in the mid-20s, it was just a little movie town. But lucky for Fernandez, there were lots of roles for Mexican extras. And like Hollywood itself, Fernandez had some big ambitions.
He kind of realized that he wanted to be a filmmaker. So he said he was learning his trade and he would pay other extras for their call. So if they got a call to be on a movie for, I don't know, a dollar a day, he'd say, I'll pay you $2. I want your call.
And then in 1928, when he was working on the movie Ramona, he laid eyes on Dolores Del Rio. Dolores Del Rio was also from Mexico, but she was way out of his league. She came from old money in Mexico City, and she was already a star. I wander up yonder. In fact, that's her voice you hear, right there. Where the mountains high, if you kiss the sky. And then one day, on the set of Ramona, she noticed him.
El Indio estaba en la banca de los extras bailarines.
El Indio was sitting with the extras at the dancers' bench, and Dolores del Río gets up, points to him and says to her assistant, I forgot my coat at the other end of the studio.
Dile a ese indio, dice Dolores.
Tell that Indian to get my coat. That was the moment he took his nickname, El Indio.
It was technically true. Fernandez was half Kickapoo on his mother's side, but it wasn't exactly a compliment. Now, here comes the funny coincidence. At the same time that Emilio Fernandez was mooning over Dolores Del Rio, Dolores Del Rio was about to become engaged to MGM art director Cedric Gibbons. Cedric Gibbons was one of the 36 founding members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and it was his job to design an award that they could hand out. He'd already sketched an idea, but he needed a statue, not a drawing, so he asked the sculptor George Stanley to make it in 3 dimensions. And this is where Fernandez enters the picture. Some stories say Gibbons happened to have Fernandez's casting photo on his desk. Other stories say Dolores Del Rio tipped him off. But in all the stories, when Gibbons approaches Fernandez to ask if he'll pose,
él se niega a posar.
El Indio refused. He refused to pose for the sculptor because he had to do it in the nude.
He was a little bit of a prude.
A prude with a huge crush.
Ya se sabía que el Indio Fernández tenía un cariño o una atención especial.
Everybody knew that el Indio Fernández was fond of Dolores del Río, that he kind of had a thing for her.
Entonces, todo esto se confabula.
So everything comes into place, and it's Dolores del Río who goes to Emilio Fernández and asks, will you please pose for the sculpture so he can finish the trophy?
That did the trick. Fernández posed, Stanley sculpted, and they made a mold. They sent that mold to the California Brass Foundry. In the time since then, more than 3,000 Fernandezes have been cast, buffed, and dipped in gold. Eventually, both Fernandez and Del Rio went back to Mexico. Fernandez started working as a director, and when Del Rio's life in Hollywood fell apart, Fernandez offered her a role. They made many movies together, but the greatest of them all was Maria Candelaria. Fernandez wrote it for Del Rio as a birthday gift, and in the role he wrote for her, she's an indigenous woman, ese indio. In some ways, it's a lot like the Oscar story. In the movie, Maria Candelaria poses for an artist, except this time, when the artist asks Maria Candelaria to pose nude, she refuses, and she doesn't budge. The movie won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1946. As for the Oscar, El Indio Fernandez never did get to take one home.
And the Oscar goes...
And the Oscar
Posey Gruner is a producer at KNKX in Seattle. She produced that piece for us in 2014, and you can see what Emilio Fernandez looked like at studio360.org. As for how the statue got to be called Oscar, nobody really knows. This year, the Academy nominated Quentin Tarantino for 3 Emilios. I mean, Oscars. Best Picture, Best Director, and Original Screenplay, all for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. All of Tarantino's films are about other movies, and this one especially so, right down to the title. It is an homage to the Italian director Sergio Leone and his films Once Upon a Time in the West and Once Upon a Time in America. And in Tarantino's movie, Leonardo DiCaprio plays a Hollywood actor on a downhill career slide who stars in some very Leone-esque Italian westerns.
Sergio who?
Sergio Carbucci.
Hey, who and who's that?
The second best director of spaghetti westerns in the whole wide world. He's doing a new western. It's called Nebraska Jim. And because of me, he's considering you.
Back in 2010, I asked Quentin Tarantino about how seeing Sergio Leone's movies as a young man affected him.
Oh, very profoundly. I mean, yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't think I knew Sergio Leone by name at that time, but they would say, like,
spaghetti western.
Oh, well, like when they would say Duck, You Sucker came out from the man that brought you Good and the Bad and the Ugly and for a few dollars more. Like, oh, I want to see that.
Yeah.
Because my mom actually had a huge crush on Clint Eastwood at that time. So we went and saw all of his films. I mean, Where Eagles Dare and the Dollars movies, you know, they became touchstones for me. And it was only years later that I realized how much I respond to the style of them, but actually they're some of the first movies I actually remember seeing in the theaters. And as far as I'm concerned, they really created modern filmmaking. They took filmmaking out of the 50s and out of the early 60s and really introduced, and then followed by Sam Peckinpah and The Wild Bunch. They introduced us to modern filmmaking. They are the first, you know, the way we use music now, the way we cut to music. Movies were never cut to music before.
Right.
They were not cut rhythmically.
Yeah. The way we do violence.
Yeah, and the way we do violence. I mean, I've suffered for a long time. I might have gotten over it finally, but I've suffered forever for Sergio Leone-itis, where, you know, I can't introduce a character unless I spend 15 minutes doing it and making it a huge operatic aria as they're introduced or there's some set piece.
Right. In Pulp Fiction, the one thing about it that absolutely thrilled me at the time and I never saw talked about much, and I still think about sometimes, is the moment when Uma Thurman does the "Don't be a square,"
yeah,
and she, with her fingers, makes a little square in midair, and you animate that,
yeah,
which was just this sort of thrilling, wait a minute, this is a more or less realistic movie, and he's suddenly done this bizarre cartoon hallucinatory thing, and then doesn't return to it.
Come on, man, let's go get a steak.
You can get a steak here, Daddy-O. Don't be a...
Oh, after you, kitty cat.
Are you tempted to do things like that and kind of color outside the lines all the time when you make movies?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing, to me, the thing that made that cool was I didn't do anything like it again.
Yes.
And when you see something like that and it works, when you pull it off, when you pull out
it's a wink.
Yeah, that's exactly. I, a wink is a good way to. I also described it like a kiss.
Yeah.
I just gave the audience a little smooch.
Yeah.
You know, the animated section in Kill Bill, you know, serves a similar function. I had to like fight and not put that in the trailer. And I'm like, no, if you know it's coming, then it has no function at all.
Pulp Fiction famously resurrected John Travolta's career, and you kind of did the same for Pam Grier and Jackie Brown and in Kill Bill, which you just talked about, the late David Carradine. Let's listen to a scene from that film, one of those films, rather, when he's confronted by Uma Thurman.
You and I have unfinished business.
Baby, you ain't kidding.
You said that's your most personal movie, or did at the time. Really?
I'm not going to tell you why. I said I like to hide in plain sight.
Because of an ex-girlfriend you tried to kill at once?
No. Again, no. It's a personal story brought to crazy, mythological comic book Amazonian rites of passage.
All of your films, to lesser or greater degrees, are about movies.
Yeah, no. Well... I am a genre filmmaker. I like working inside of a genre. I like working personally from my heart inside of a genre, because that way I can reveal myself, but I can reveal myself without revealing myself. I can hide in plain sight. I do a genre story. I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to tell what's ever important going on with me at the time. But now, I don't want you to know what's going on with me at the time. But if I put it inside of a genre, my close friends might know. But then I get to actually relate personally, but I'm still telling an exciting tale one way or the other.
Well, painting got to a point 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago, where good, serious, ambitious paintings were all about art. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, instead of just being about making pictures. Maybe that's where you are in the history of cinema.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, though, I mean, on one hand, Jackie Brown isn't about cinema. It's about these characters. But yet, I'm not afraid of genre. And so I make it this almost love letter to blaxploitation movies.
Right.
But it's not a blaxploitation movie. There's nothing exploitive about Jackie Brown at all.
No, it's a blaxploitation movie in quotes.
Very much so. But I think there's going to be a part of my cinema that will always have that quotes around it.
Yeah.
But because I'm not afraid of cinema.
Right.
I love cinema. I'm not trying to make cinema disappear. You know, could you imagine an author having read too many books?
No, or alluding to Shakespeare to Dickens or whatever.
Yeah, no, I love cinema. I have no problem basking in cinema and its history with my stories.
Quentin Tarantino's latest movie about movies, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, was nominated for 10 Oscars, including acting awards for the two main stars, Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. But if you happen to watch the movie on TV, you may not be hearing Brad Pitt's actual voice the whole time, because Tarantino's scripts are famously foul-mouthed and broadcast unacceptable as is.
All the streets are silent. Except when Rick Dalton's got a fucking shotgun, I'll tell you that.
Goddamn right.
Back in the 2000s, we talked with a voiceover actor who has a specialty: dubbing over the smutty lines of Brad Pitt.
Basically, this scene, he's in hot water. He's trying to explain himself. He's lying. So you got to take all those emotions, all what's going on, and put it into just one frickin' scene.
My name's Mark Sussman. I'm from Studio City. I'm a comic actor. The studios call me in to take out the bad language for TV and airplanes.
I don't understand.
What's it going to take, Jerry? For the gun, Jerry. What's it going to take for you to give it to me and not to another?
Who the frick are these guys?
Who the frick are these guys?
You know what? Not even important.
Who the frick are these guys?
You give me one good reason why I shouldn't fight to my death to not give you the gun.
I used to do a lot of acting when I was younger, like 21 Jump Street, and I could go way back. Like, the first thing I did was like Highway to Heaven. I used to think it's like, oh, they just kind of like, what the frick? You know, and then they just superimpose that one word. But actually, if you see it, you know, on TV or something, it's that whole sentence that I'm doing. So that's why I like the challenge of doing like the entire paragraph, or like, oh great, I get to do all these lines.
Oh, such an ass.
I'm such a jerk.
You're such an ass.
I'm course. Such a jerk.
Give the gun to Leroy, he'll get it down to Margulies. Ha, f***ing ha!
Ha, freaking ha!
You see? Do you see?
You see?
I'm being set up!
And even that, what, you know what I mean? And I have to go, what, frick! Frick! You know? Isn't that crazy? Frick! I wish I talked like that in real life. My mom would be very proud of me. Actually, I caught myself one time, like, oh, frick! And they're like, you know, what am I, like Little House on the Prairie or something? What's going on? If I have to go in and I have to take out the bad language at a specific movie, I'll just watch that movie over and over again, and I'll watch the scenes where they cuss in it over and over again, and then I'll tape it. And then when I'm driving to the studio, I'll listen to it in headphones over and over again. Also, I always look for a specific physicality, you know, that's really important to me, because in order to embody a character, in order to give a voice to a character, you have to physically embody the character. It's not from the neck up, it's the whole thing, even if people don't see it. So like with Brad Pitt, the way I got him down for Fight Club and stuff, I noticed that he licks his lips a lot. And that gives his, like, I don't know, that's how he is, you know? Jewish Brad Pitt, you know what I mean? I can't pay you. We need the ride. See, his voice is kind of deep, so I just go down here like this. We need a ride. We need a frickin' ride. A lift. you know, and he's kind of surfer, kind of like that kind of guy. And he also has a raspy voice. He's very into his lips. I feel that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a lesser art form. I think it's a different art form. Just like acting or painting or voiceover work, if you have an ability and you can do it and you're good at it, it's just like painting. It's just like being in front of the camera.
Ben Adair and Ayala Ben-Yehuda produced our story at KPCC in Pasadena. The real Brad Pitt was nominated for an Oscar this year for his role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. By the way, at a party during a Hollywood Awards weekend years ago, I stepped on Brad Pitt's foot, accidentally, but hard. His bodyguard was pretty unhappy. Coming up...
Pedro Almodóvar is a very tough director. It's not easy working with him.
Why Antonio Banderas keeps returning to the longtime collaborator who discovered it.
He managed to bring out of me a character that I didn't even know I had inside.
The Oscar-nominated actor on his complicated relationship with Pedro Almodóvar. That's next on Studio 360.
Studio 360.
There was in 1980. I was 19. I was working at that time at the National Theater in Spain. I got long hair, a little mustache, and a fly beard.
That's the actor Antonio Banderas talking about meeting this guy in Madrid, a young film director named Pedro Almodóvar.
And I was outside of the theater in a coffee shop with some of the other actors of the play. And this man with a red briefcase appeared over there, sit with us without even introducing himself. He knew some of the members of the company. And so he started throwing this monologue that was very funny. I don't remember what he talked about, but I remember that I laughed. He was ingenious, fast. He used a lot of irony and certain cynicism too. And suddenly, well, after 20 minutes of giving us this homily, he stood up to leave. He looked at me, says, "You should do movies. You got a very romantic face. You should be in movies. Goodbye." Boom. And he left. And I asked somebody, "Who is this guy?" And they said to me, "His name is Pedro Almodóvar. He made one movie, and he will never make another one." I saw him again like 3 or 4 weeks after that, and he came to see the play, and at the end, they came to my dressing room, and he offered me a movie called Labyrinth of Passion. And I, at that time, I never did a movie before, so I said to him, basically, I'm a theater actor. I have never done a movie. I don't know if I can answer to expectations. And he said, "Oh, if you do theater, you will be fine in movies. I will direct you. Don't worry. Everything's going to be fine." I said, "Okay, sure."
Since then, Antonio Banderas and Pedro Almodóvar have made a bunch of movies together. 5 pretty much back-to-back in the 1980s in Spain. But then a 2-decade hiatus while Banderas was pursuing his Hollywood career. Philadelphia with Tom Hanks, Evita, The Mask of Zorro, the Spy Kids movies, Puss in Boots, and on and on. But once again, he has reunited with the director who discovered him for last year's terrific film, Pain and Glory, which is their 8th together. It was nominated for an Oscar for Best International Film and Banderas for Best Actor. He plays this older, complicated film director, a character closely based on Almodóvar. The Almodóvar-esque character in Pain and Glory has medical problems, a heroin habit, flashes back a lot to his childhood, and reunites with long-lost friends and lovers and collaborators over the course of the film.
I would describe the film as the story of a man who is an artist, who is a movie director, who actually is going back in time in order to close certain wounds that were left open, to reconciliate with himself, to come to terms with certain people. And basically, the movie is that. In the middle of that, there is a reflection about art, and about movies in particular, and about life itself.
Right. You, too, have known each other for almost 40 years. So was playing this character inspired by him, this version of him, when he came to you and said, "Hey, you want to do this?" Was that enticing, scary, awkward, what?
All of it. Well, it was relieving to me. Because the last movie I did with him was 9 years ago. It was The Skin I Live In.
This ghastly, weird vengeance movie about a plastic surgeon.
Yeah, the only Almodóvar. only Almodóvar. And before than that, for 22 years, we didn't work together.
Yes.
So I arrived to The Skin I Live In, and I'm going to just go back 9 years because the creation of this character started there without even me knowing. You know, when I got there at the rehearsal, because Pedro Almodóvar is one of those movie directors who rehearse for a long period of time.
Weeks? Just,
weeks, yeah, a month approximately, you know, prior to principal photography. But I arrived there after 22 years in America. You know, I have learned a bunch of things, Pedro. You know, I just behave in front of the camera in a different way. I'm more secure. I can use my voice in this way. And after a week...
I'm a grown-up.
I know, exactly. And so after a week of rehearsal, he said to me, you know, all of those things that you have learned there, I cannot use. Those are things that are not really for me. So where are you? He asked me. And at that time, instead of actually answering that question or try to answer that question, I thought, oh my God, why is he so harsh on me? You know, I'm going to go my path. I'm just going to use, you know, all the things that I have learned just to find my character. And, you know, but, you know, it creates certain tension on the set. Anyway, we finished that shooting, and then I saw the movie in the Toronto Film Festival, and I saw it, and I couldn't believe that he managed to bring out of me a character that I didn't even know I had inside. So at that point, I said, oh, I think I should be a little bit more humble than that.
Yeah.
I should open my ears and my eyes and listen to people that are, especially people that I trust. And I trust Pedro Almodóvar. I started doing movies with him almost 40 years ago. Am I going to have an opportunity again just to work with him?
And a decade later, you did.
Yeah. And the opportunity came one day that he called me on the phone. He said, I'm going to send you this script called Pain and Glory. And you are going to find a bunch of references that have to do with our life, you know, in the 80s and the movies that we did at that time. And you're going to find very familiar characters in there. And so I called him after I read the script and I loved it. And I said, listen, I am going, you know, clean. I am not going to use all the tools that I have been using this year. I want to just start something absolutely new. I want to start from the scratch with you.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to listen to you. And I want to know, basically, why do you want to do this movie? And why did you call me to play you?
So in terms of the character, the Almodóvar character you play, it doesn't particularly resemble him in the way he moves or talks.
No. No, he surrounds the characters in the physicality of it, you know. The hair is very similar to the hair that he uses. You know, all the costumes, the colors. He got an exact replica of his apartment in Madrid.
Right.
But then he came to the point in which he said to me one day on rehearsal, if you want to use some of my mannerism for the character, you can do it. And I said, no. We are going to stop in there. I don't think I should do that. I think I should create the character from the inside out. If I just try to imitate you, it's not going to be a performance. It's going to be an imitation. I don't think it's the right way to attack this. We are going to lose points there.
Right.
We should just do another type of creation there. And he says, okay. So we started just working in that aspect in a completely different way.
How is working with him, the actual work on the set, making the movie, how is that different with him than all the dozens of other directors you've worked with?
Pedro Almodóvar is a very tough director. It's not easy working with him. He's very demanding, very meticulous. He knows exactly what he wants, and he's not going to let you go in different directions. You can bring things, but at the end, you know, you have to go and understand what he's trying to do and get in a parallel line with him. If you don't do that, you're going to have a hard time.
Does he get better performances out of you than other directors?
I think so. But because he doesn't allow you to go off the truth. I mean, and especially now. I suppose there is age, too. You know, there is a moment in when you get to a certain age, and I am in that place, too, already, in which there is only space for the truth. Only space for the truth. You know, everything else starts looking stupid and ridiculous, so you're just searching for that.
Because time is short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Another thing that strikes me as interesting is this character that you play is gay. You are not.
Right.
But many of the characters you've played for Pedro, who is gay, are gay.
Yeah.
Because why?
I don't know, but I don't have any problem with that. Yeah. I never did have a problem.
Do gay people now because have a problem with that because straight people aren't supposed to play gay people these days?
I don't know. I received an award in 2006 by the, it was called the GLAAD Award, by the gay community Los Angeles because of the way that I represented them.
Right.
And I am very proud of that award. And so I try to do it with, flair and, and try to just give my soul and my heart to them.
In Hollywood, you have been cast, you are cast as variously this mysterious romantic leading man a lot and an action hero, Zorro, The Expendables, or spoofs of those, like one of my favorite films of yours, Puss in Boots, Spy Kids. And so, not to say you're typecast, but, a lot of your films are those two kinds of characters. Whereas with Almodovar, there's this incredible range of characters you've played over these, 35, 40 years. Ailing filmmaker, kicking heroine, mad scientist, gay terrorist. Is part of the attraction that you're going to get to do all kinds of things that you don't know if you can do with him? It's almost as if you have two different careers. You have the Almodovar career and the other career.
Yeah, it's true. No, I don't know if that's the attraction is for the character. I recognize in Pedro Almodovar a real artist, somebody. I mean, his movies, and they are very radical. And the people actually also react in a radical way. You have people who love Pedro Almodovar and people don't like the Pedro Almodovar movies. But there is something that anybody can actually, they have to recognize. This is a guy with a tremendous, strong personality, very unique, that never betrayed himself. He's absolutely loyal to his style. He never went and said, I'm going to just change my cinematography.
I'm going to be a hack.
Because of money. Received offers from Hollywood. He received offers from anybody. Never accepted that. He has been there persistently for 21 movies nonstop. And that is, in our days especially, is a virtue. So I love to be there in that space, that smell and it taste like truth. Truth artist, And then I understand that, art in general and movies in particular, they just serve many different purposes in life. And I don't have anything to, against a movie that just pretends just to entertain people, which is...
You've made some of those.
I made some of those, of course, because there are people that they love to go to the movie theaters after they've been working the whole entire week with their girlfriends or their boyfriends and have a big part of popcorn and enjoy 2 hours of a good entertainment. And there are other people who love to go to movies just to explore about the human spirit and the complications of the soul and the depth of the soul of the mankind. There are all of those spaces. If you don't try to just lie to the audience, you're fine.
Right.
So I have done all of those because I am an actor. And that's what I am. And I love those actors that in the old days in Spain, they used to go like the circus people. And in the morning, they do a comedy. And at night, they do Shakespeare. And that's what they are. And so I try just to keep that in my mind. I don't want to become crazy when I talk about the creation of a career. And sometimes the creation of a career is you have to renounce an incredible amount of things that you would love to do, but your agent says, no, you have to be coherent.
Really?
This is what the audience is responding to beautifully. So you should go in that path. Don't leave that path. You are going to just make one break after the other. You're going to be a very beautiful career. And I don't like that.
That's their creation, your career.
That's right. And I don't like that. I like to be, as I said to you, an actor.
Right.
And I like to play a comedy sometimes. And I like to play a movie for kids.
Sure, sure.
And at the same time, I have to recognize that in Hollywood, I have a certain... I was limited in my possibilities because of my accent.
And you spoke no English whatsoever when you got to Hollywood.
Because I arrived there with 30 years old, And so these are the range of possibilities that I have. I have to play with those cards. I didn't have all the range of cards in my hands.
Right.
I only can receive these 10 cards out of the maze. So how you play with that is complicated.
Yeah.
And life is changing too at the same time. And now my body is asking me and my mind, you know, that I would like to do movies that are more, a little bit deeper, that I would like to just reflect about life, you know, about relationships, about certain events. And probably Hollywood is not providing me with that. So where can I find that? I'm going to find that in England. I'm going to find that in Spain, in Europe. You know, so I am searching. I am not in a hurry for anything. I've done 112 movies. I'm going to be 60 next year. I'm fine.
And you moved to London 4 years ago, right?
Yeah, I'm living in London, and I'm content. I'm satisfied.
Antonio Banderas, this has been a pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, really.
Antonio Banderas was nominated for Best Actor for his role in Pain and Glory, which was also up for Best International Feature Film at the Academy Awards. And that's it for this week's program. Studio 360 is a production of PRI, Public Radio International, in association with Slate. Our production team consists of
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Sandra Lopez Monsalve,
Evan Chung,
Lauren Hansen,
Sam Kim,
Zoe Saunders,
Tommy Bazarian,
Morgan Flannery.
And I'm Kurt Anderson.
He's very into his lips. I feel that.
Thanks very much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time on Studio 360, the magic that brought us Yanni and John Tesh.
I realized that if I was going to have a real full-time music career, that it was going to have to be some big event.
The unlikely vehicle to stardom in the 1990s. PBS pledge drives.
What I needed was something like a PBS special to make a whole bunch of loud noise.
That's next time on Studio 360.